KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. Welcome indeed to a new quarter on KZSU's calendar. I'm very excited to be starting Hearsay Culture again and look forward to a very exciting quarter of quite a wide variety of guests, people in the IP sector as well as technologists, quite a few authors, so it should be a fun semester. Today I'm very excited to have on an intellectual property law scholar whose work I highly regard, Professor Bobby Quall, who is currently visiting at Tulane Law School in New Orleans, but who is the Raymond P. Nero Professor of Intellectual Property Law at DePaul University College of Law in Chicago. Professor Quall's writing is extensive. It's work, again, that is well known in the IP scholar fields. Her work, both scholarly as well as textbooks that she's written, as well as countless other honors that she's received, has made her quite an influential scholar in the field. And so, as I mentioned to Bobby before we started the show, I was very excited when she agreed to do the show. Today we're going to be discussing a work that Bobby is currently in the process of drafting and putting together, and indeed, what I have to discuss today are numerous chapters from her book called The Soul of Creativity: Should Intellectual Property Law Protect the Integrity of a Creator's Work? And of course, that is a question mark at the end of that title. This work is a very challenging work, and I think brings to the forefront a theory of copyright law in particular, which, as Bobby will, I'm sure, explain in more detail, is kind of given short shrift, at least in the U.S. And the focus here of Bobby's work really is on authors' rights and moral rights with respect to copyright. As we know, generally, anyone that focuses on intellectual property in the United States knows the basic theory of intellectual property is primarily utilitarian. The economic incentives that occur and are inherent in the use of copyright and other forms of intellectual property to encourage the creation of works. The focus of Bobby's book, however, is really focusing on what she calls in her introduction the, quote, intrinsic workings of creative enterprise. In other words, what is it, and I, of course, will allow Bobby to even correct what I'm saying, and certainly I will say up front that this is a gross simplification, but really, what is the intrinsic effort, what are the intrinsic values that an author brings to a work, and how should those values be translated once the work goes public? We think about these issues often when we think about things like fair use, an area which is, of course, highly litigated and will continue to be highly litigated in the world of copyright. But we also think about it when we think about simply what is an author's work and how does it relate to them as a person. Sometimes we talk about these theories as personhood, the idea that an author's work, and in this case copyright, is an extension of themselves. But really what we're talking about broadly boils down to questions of what rights does an author have to control the kind of work that they put out there and how it's used post its publication, post its dissemination publicly. There are a lot of fascinating angles to this, and in Bobby's work we're going to be discussing several of them, because two areas and focuses of her scholarship in this particular book are psychology as well as theology. And we don't often see, although certainly I think we should see, more connection between psychological theories as well as theological theories and authorship. On Hearsay Culture, for those of you who have been listening for a while, you'll know that I have had on a few behavioral economists who focus particularly on behavioral economics and their theories and are starting to draw links between behavioral economics and intellectual property. This work really ties together a wide variety of scholarship, an enormous amount of disciplines. In fact, we'll be talking with Bobby about some of the challenges in going into these areas. But without further explaining what's going on, I'd rather just start the conversation directly with Bobby Quall. So hopefully my engineering prowess has worked well after a several-week break. Bobby, are you on the other end of the phone?
Yes, I am, David, and thank you so much once again for inviting me to be on your program. It truly is an honor, and thank you.
Well, thank you. The honor's mine. I'm really excited to have you here. Let's start right off, Bobby, with kind of a standard question that I ask of all of my guests, particularly authors. Explain your background a little bit more, and particularly, why did you choose to write this particular work?
Well, my background, as you said, is that I've been a law professor working in the areas of intellectual property for, you know, over 20 years. It's actually an area in which I practiced before going into teaching, and it's an area I loved. In terms of moral rights, I actually wrote my very first law review article as a law professor on moral rights, and that particular work, which was published in the Vanderbilt Law Review, really looked at the current Copyright Act, which was which at the time was and is the 1976 Copyright Act, and I explored that act from the standpoint of why don't we have moral rights, and how a moral rights system both interfaces with the current copyright law that we had at the time, and this was pre-Byrne, I should say, and pre the Visual Artists Rights Act that we currently have, which are a small version of moral rights, but were not in effect at that time. And what in the copyright statute actually would negate or go against moral rights. And that was my very, very first article as an academic, and I've been very interested in that area ever since I began teaching. This work, the book that I'm now writing, which by the way Stanford Press is going to be publishing, is a work that really, in some ways, is very much the capstone of the work I've done over the past 20 years on moral rights. And the question that I started out with is not so much what does the law do or what doesn't it do, but really, how do we think about authors' rights, and in particular human enterprise and creativity, in this country that has particularly shaped our vision of moral rights? And in particular, what forces are we not considering in the United States that may be perhaps taken for granted elsewhere? But what has escaped, what areas, what theories have basically not been included in the discourse in this country on moral rights? And how can we begin to think about them and perhaps include them in our discourse? And that was really that line of inquiry, David, was really the impetus for my work in this particular book.
As we get into many of the theories that you discuss in the book, perhaps it would be good for listeners who aren't as familiar with copyright law outside of the United States, or indeed inside the U.S., but focusing internationally, if you could give, and I ask quite a few unfair questions of guests occasionally, especially where we have an hour limitation, but if you could give maybe a couple of minute overview of what you see as two or three significant distinctions between international quote-unquote law and U.S. law as it relates to copyright, that might help orient the discussion.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, what I'm talking about here, the doctrine that my book is concerned with, essentially is a doctrine called moral rights. What that means for purposes of this discussion are basically two types of rights. Let me say, first of all, that copyright law in the United States is about safeguarding certain economic rights. Okay, so as people who are familiar with copyright law know that in the United States, and this is really true pretty much elsewhere, copyright law allows the copyright owner, who I must say may or may not be the author, because you can always, as an author, assign your copyright. I mean, that's something that not everybody necessarily understands initially, but as an author, you have the copyrights subject to certain technical doctrines, like if you create the work for someone else and it's a work for hire. But putting that aside, as the author, you have the copyright. You, however, may assign the copyright, in which case, although you are still the colloquial author in the sense that you've rendered the work, you are not the copyright owner. And what copyright law does is enable the copyright owner to safeguard certain economic rights by virtue of the work. In other words, the right to reproduce the work, the right to distribute the work, the right to publicly perform the work and publicly display the work, and finally the right to create a new work, or what the copyright law calls a derivative work, based on the underlying copyrighted work. So that's what copyright law essentially affords authors here in the United States. And again, that system is more or less similar elsewhere. Where the United States departs from the rest of the world is in its failure to incorporate moral rights. Now, what moral rights essentially afford, and what I'm concentrating on here, are basically two moral rights, and those two are basically the mainstay of moral rights, and they are the focus of my book. The first is the right to attribution. Nowhere in that, when I listed the sticks in the bundle of copyright, okay, did I mention the right to be attributed as the author. That simply is not part of our copyright law, and a lot of people find that very surprising when they hear that for the first time. So the right of attribution is something we don't have unless it happens to be negotiated for separately in a contract. Secondly, the right of integrity. And what the right of integrity means is essentially the right to ensure that your work is presented to the public in a way that is not modified, defaced, altered, presented in a context that you would find objectionable, or otherwise violative of the author's artistic integrity. When I use the term, by the way, in the title of my book, Should Intellectual Property Law Protect the Integrity of a Creator's Work, and I talk about safeguarding textual integrity, what I mean by that is together the right of attribution and the right of integrity in moral rights law. Both of them function in a way that enables an author, at least in other countries, many other countries, I would say most other countries, to safeguard the integrity of a creator's text. And that's what I'm talking about.
It's obviously the kind of work that would not fit easily into your typical law review article, one that requires, given the breadth of your, of the challenges that you're taking up here, require a book-length analysis. And indeed, as I mentioned in the introduction, before we get into the substance, you tackle two areas that we don't normally look at when we're thinking about intellectual property, those being theology as well as psychology. So I might ask you, as an author now, dealing with these two areas, do you have a background in them? And if you don't have a significant background, what were some of the challenges?
Well, in terms of the, I can tell you a little bit about how it came into be that I began delving into those theories. And to answer your question initially, in terms of theology, I actually do have a very strong background in Jewish studies. I majored in religion in college. I've learned over the years. I'm actually currently enrolled in a doctoral program in Judaic studies, and I've studied in Israel. And so Jewish studies is something that I actually do have a significant background in, if not a formal graduate degree, at least not yet. The reason I actually began thinking about what facilitates creativity, what are the parameters of human creativity, what drives the creative process, if you will. The way this project began actually grows out of my interest more in Jewish studies, believe it or not. Hmm. What happened was I was reading a book several summers ago, and the book was by Daniel Boorstin, the former Librarian of Congress, and it's called The Creators, Heroes of the Imagination. It's about 750 pages, and I had a wonderful summer reading it, cover to cover. In that book, Daniel Boorstin makes a really interesting point. He talks about the creation narratives in Genesis. In the Bible. And he says that these narratives, the narrative specifically that whereby God, according to the narratives, creates the world. And he says that these narratives furnish a path for man to think of himself as a potential creator. Now, I have to tell you, when I read that, I was very blown away, to put it, just very, very candidly, because certainly I had been thinking about authors' rights at that point for 20 years. I've also read the Genesis narratives, hundreds of times, given my interest in religion, but I had never put the two together. I had really never thought about the relationship between authors' rights and the Genesis narratives as a pathway, thinking for how man thinks about human enterprise and human creativity. So I thought, gee, wouldn't it be interesting to actually do a biblical exegesis of the text of those Genesis narratives, see what it is that the sources, and by the sources there, I mean the rabbinic sources, say about what, how can we mine the Genesis narratives and their interpretations, particularly in the early rabbinic community, for what they tell us about human creativity. And that was my project at the outset. So I spent a year or so really delving into that with the help of a very, very good research assistant who was completely fluent in Hebrew and could really tap into those sources for me. And when I came out of that research, I really had a very nice way and mechanism for explaining human creativity according to the Jewish tradition, which I found to be the area that I was going to initially write about. One of my colleagues at DePaul said to me, you know, that's all fine and well, but we're, you know, a Christian country predominantly at this point, and if you really want to understand what the U.S. is doing with moral rights and what narrative it's allowing, you need to look at the Christian tradition. And I thought that was a point well taken. So I actually did a lot of research then on the Christian tradition, finding that in the Christian tradition, the concepts as to what motivates humans to create paralleled completely the Judaic sources that I had spent a lot of time researching. Not surprising, really, given the common roots of the two religions.
Right.
So I thought this is a good thing. And then I thought, you know, it really is important to see what artists are saying about their narratives and what the social psychologists are saying. And so when I went to the social psychological literature, you know, here I do have less of a background. I have to be candid. I've never studied psychology formally other than, you know, just here and there in college and whatnot. But the books were accessible to me in the sense that there's a lot of works being written by creativity theorists that are actually not terribly difficult for a person without a substantial background to understand. And lo and behold, and this was probably the most exciting for me, is that I found that what I tapped into in the theological literature was certainly prevalent in the literature of the creativity theorists, the psychologists, as well as the narratives of authors themselves. And it was that package of human creativity that I looked at and that I wrote about, and that was the basis for the theoretical predicate for moral rights that I try to establish in this book.
It's a fascinating area, and I think we can kind of start that discussion and perhaps make those connections that may not be and certainly wouldn't potentially be apparent to people up front by asking about your title itself. And you mentioned it a little bit at the beginning, but obviously it's a very specific title that makes a lot more sense based upon your discussion, the soul of creativity. What do you mean when you use the word soul? What are you trying to convey with respect to that title, and also what are you advancing in terms of our understanding of copyright law and, as you mentioned, authorship?
Well, clearly the term the soul of creativity, you're right, David, it has a very charged message, right? Because when we think of the soul of something, we really are thinking about something inspirational and something spiritual. And that's what I'm trying to convey in that, because I do regard the creative process as something that is inspirationally motivated or spiritually motivated. And that is how I see creativity, especially after the research I've done in these other areas that confirms, in fact, how I look at creativity. It's not just about economics. It's about a lot more than that. And so that title is actually very indicative of that. In terms of the question, you know, should intellectual property law protect the integrity of a creator's work, that question is a controversial question, as you well know. Particularly in the Legal Academy, which is the place that I spend most of my time in terms of interacting with other colleagues, there is a view, and it's a predominant one in the Legal Academy, that intellectual property law in general and copyright law in particular has become too expansive. We are stifling the public domain, and we ought to minimize copyright protections. Copyright law lasts far too long than it should. It protects far too much than it should. And so the notion that we need to give some serious thought to moral rights, which are, I call moral rights a cousin of copyright law, because moral rights apply to works that are, in fact, copyrighted. Okay, you can't have moral rights without having an underlying copyrighted work. Nonetheless, what I'm advocating is, in some respects, enhanced protection, copyright protection. And that notion is a little bit controversial. And so the real challenge for me in this book is you know, not so much incorporating the interdisciplinary theories, because that was pure joy for me, and that was really fascinating. The labor of this work is to use that theory to then propose viable moral rights protection that will not only be true to the theories that I'm looking at and that I'm promulgating, but that will also be viable in the United States. And by viable, I mean two things. I mean practical, given our current legal structure, because our laws are different from the laws of the rest of the world in some ways. We have the First Amendment, for example. And secondly, not only are they practical, but are they constitutional? And again, given the First Amendment and other considerations, I have to be very careful about how I propose a moral rights structure, because I want it to be something that will satisfy our legal copyright climate in the United States and not be too far afield from what folks who are participating in the copyright discourse here in the U.S. will be willing to accept. And that is the real challenge that I'm actually working through now. That's the last chapter of my book. You haven't seen that because it's not written yet.
Right.
But that's what I'm struggling with. How do we implement moral rights?
Yeah, and, you know, I will say, and, you know, in order to have the discussion, I don't think it would be fair without really confronting this issue up front, and you've brought it up, and I think it is an enormous challenge, because focusing exclusively on your title, the soul of creativity is certainly a charged term, but then you focus on a question which is, in my estimation, even more provocative to those who, as you mentioned, focus on the public domain and commons theory, which, as you know, and as we can discuss a little bit, is a prevalent area in intellectual property law generally. You asked the question, should intellectual property law protect the integrity of a creator's work? And as you well know, and as you alluded to, that statement itself can provoke quite a strong reaction from those that think that too much is being done to protect the integrity, if you will, of an author's work up front. So in order to allow you to, and I recognize, and I will repeat, that this is an area of the work that you're still developing, so I don't want to, nor would I suggest that whatever response you have is the final answer to your work and that you're thinking it through. So perhaps I'll ask the question this way. Currently, based upon where you are, how do you respond to a potential challenge that says that what you're really talking about at the end of the day is how do we come up with a tighter control system for authors?
With a
stronger IP than we currently exists in the U.S. with respect to an author's rights to control the use of their work.
Sure. Okay. Well, and I'll be happy to answer that, and I'll be happy to share with you what I'm thinking about in terms of structuring moral rights. So I'm happy to talk about that, even though, again, that part of my thought process is still very much a work in progress. But I'm getting it together in terms of trying to come up with perhaps some legislative directives, and I'll be very, very happy to talk about all of that in the context of this discussion. So in order to understand how I think about those issues specifically, should IP law protect the integrity of a creator's work, you have to take a couple steps back. And the first thing I'd like to emphasize is that when I speak about, this inspirational dimension of creativity. And again, I haven't really gotten into exactly what it is that what those forces are that are inspirationally based, that essentially compel human enterprise. What are those non-economic forces that compel a creator to create and not necessarily think about the monetary aspect of that? And we certainly could discuss that. Again, they're mentioned, I discussed those in my book, but I think for purposes of this discussion, maybe we'll start by saying that they exist, that they're powerful, and that maybe we can for now just take as a given the idea that when people create, there are certain internal forces that drive this process that are based on that notion of I want to do this based on my internal directives. I'm not responding to the external drive of money or other kinds of rewards. It's internally based. And without going into necessarily detail on that, I just want to maybe give you one soundbite of something that I just found incredibly provocative when I was doing this research that I think listeners perhaps can relate to.
Okay.
And then we can go on and talk about the connection to IP protections that you asked about, David. One of the things that really brought together the interdisciplinary research and that really illustrated in a very powerful way for me this internal drive to create was the findings of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who died during the time I was doing this research. She was the psychiatrist who pioneered the five stages of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an article about her that appeared shortly after her death, in which she discussed what motivated her to think about death and dying to the extent that she did. And what it was is that after the end of World War II, she visited a concentration camp, a liberated concentration camp. And what she saw in the barracks were butterflies that were carved there by the inmates. And she thought about those butterflies throughout the rest of her life, because what they showed her is that even in the face of death and even in the most miserable of conditions, people still wanted to create. They wanted to make beautiful things. Mm-hmm. And she thought about that the rest of her life. And so, again, I illustrate the premise of this internally motivated enterprise with that example, because I think it sort of suggests in a very clear way that there are things that go on with the creative process that are internally driven. Now, if you take that internally driven process and you accept that, and you accept that it's part of it, and I'm not saying that money isn't important, and I'm not saying that money doesn't drive people. I'm saying here in the U.S., we only think about the economic narrative. We don't think about the inspirationally based narrative of creation. So I'm just trying to even the balance a bit by virtue of introducing these theories. So once you take that theory of the internal dimension of creativity and you put it on the table, where you basically end up with is the idea that the external commodity, by that I mean the work of authorship, whether it's a poem, a play, a piece of visual art, what have you, that external commodity embodies the author's intrinsic dimension of creativity.
Hmm.
You can't separate the two. You can't just say it's about the commodity. The commodity reflects the internal motivations for creativity. Further, what that commodity does is embody what I call the author's meaning and the author's intended message. Again, you can't understand what IP should do or not do until you sort of think about those concepts. A work of art, a work of authorship rather, reflects the author's meaning and the author's intended message. The meaning, as I see it, for a piece of work is basically the answer to the question of why I, as the author, got involved in doing this work, okay, what this means to me on a personal level. That's embodied in the commodity. Similarly, the message can incorporate the meaning, but it also goes a little bit beyond that. The message of a work is what I, as the author, hope others will take from the work. All right, so what I'm suggesting here is that a work of authorship embodies the original author's intended meaning and message. It also is a reflection of that. Therefore, we have to think carefully in the United States, in particular, about how the law is going to protect and safeguard that meaning and that message, because the author's ability to preserve for the audience, for posterity, that meaning and that message is part of what I understand the constitutional directive to promote progress to be. Because what promotion of progress means, according to many scholars who have looked at the constitutional predicate for copyright protection far more carefully than I have, but what that means is to disseminate knowledge. And so, when you then think about a system of law that the United States can maintain for moral rights, we have to think about those rights in the context of dissemination of knowledge. And that, I think, is the key to driving how we think about attribution and how we think about the right of integrity, which I will tell you right off the bat is far more difficult than attribution interests. Is it more difficult among the academic discourse, and it's more difficult perhaps even in practice.
It's an enormous mountain, and we're going to take a very short break and then return to discuss some of those challenges and the inadequacies that you've identified with respect to U.S. law. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU Stanford in discussion with Professor Bobby Quall, the author of the forthcoming book, The Soul of Creativity, Should Intellectual Property Law Protect the Integrity of a Creator's Work, coming out by Stanford University Press. Today, we also have the opportunity to discuss one other point, that point being the fact that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station. Therefore, what that means is we need your money in order to keep our show and our station going. Therefore, furthermore, you have an opportunity to make a contribution. You can make that contribution by one of two ways. You can either go to underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, meaning you send an email and you can make a donation, or you can go to the website for KZSU at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I do hope you continue to listen to KZSU as well as Hearsay Culture. So, Bobby, let's return to the discussion, and I'll ask you a question which I think gets to the heart of some of the concerns, and then we'll turn to the economic model. Do you feel, or I'll ask you a question this way, do you feel that elements of that are integral to copyright, like fair use, and other doctrines that do attempt to balance the interests of the author with the interests of the public, are inadequate?
Well, clearly, fair use and other excess-based doctrines within copyright law really have nothing to do with moral rights, because we don't have broad-based moral rights in the United States. I will say, just for the sake of clarity, David, that the only moral rights we do enjoy in the United States is an act called the Visual Artists' Rights Act. This was enacted in the wake of our accession to the Berne Convention back in 19, this became effective, the Visual Artists' Rights Act in 1990. That does provide some limited attribution and integrity rights only for works for authors of visual art and only for certain kinds of authors of visual art. And to answer the fair use point, I will say that the Visual Artists' Rights Act does provide that it is subject to fair use. So you have that. Now, in my opinion, VARA, the Visual Artists' Rights Act, needs to be completely rethought from the ground up. So I don't necessarily see that VARA's position in terms of allowing fair uses to necessarily govern what we could or should do with moral rights. So taking a step back, no, fair use really has nothing to do with moral rights. Fair use is about what types of uses of copyrighted works are going to be allowed to be made without payment of money. A fair use is a free use. Copyright law doesn't provide for moral rights, really, except for, again, the limited provisions of the Visual Artists' Rights Act. So in thinking about moral rights, what you really need to think about is what kinds of structure for moral rights can we have in the United States? How can we tailor them? How can we allow subsequent creators to build on existing works? And I think it's really important to clarify that in my thinking about moral rights, I am particularly concerned with the question of what kind of uses can we prohibit people to make of copyrighted works where they otherwise have the copyright ability to do so. Okay, so let me just break that down a little bit so it's clear. The greatest challenge for moral rights is when you have a situation where someone has the copyright to the work, someone other than the author has the copyright to the work. In other words, under copyright law, this individual would be able to use a work, to adapt a work, to transform a work, to display a work in a context that's consistent with copyright law. The problem is that if you afford the author, who may not be the copyright owner, because as we said before, an author can license the copyright, if you allow the author to have some control over how that work is used or modified or perceived, you're actually limiting, in some instances, the copyright owner's right. Mm-hmm. And so that's one area of challenge that we have to grapple with. It's kind of outside the fair use rubric. And so to make this a little more concrete, let me maybe give a couple of ideas that I'm thinking of in terms of what I would do with moral rights, and just sort of lay them out on the table, and then we can talk about them further if you like.
You anticipated my next question.
Pardon me?
You anticipated my next question.
Oh, okay.
So, perfect.
Okay. So there's a couple of basic things that I'd like to stress about what I would do with moral rights. First and foremost, duration of moral rights. Okay, right now, copyright law lasts, generally speaking, for the life of the author plus 70 years. And as you well know, that enhanced level of protection, which was just relatively recently increased from life plus 50 to life plus 70, has been extraordinarily controversial in the legal academy, right? So we know this. We know that people have problems with this. I believe that moral rights protection should last until the author dies. Now, that's a little controversial, even for authors' rights advocates, because even the Berne Convention seems to contemplate somewhat longer protection, though Berne is not a bar to what I'm suggesting. What I'm saying is that link, that personal intrinsic link between the author and the commodity, that link essentially is severed when the author dies. And even the author's spouse or partner or heirs really can't understand that intrinsic motivation process in the way that the author could. So for one thing, I'm putting on the table that moral rights should terminate when the author dies. That's one way in which the U.S. could really begin to think about tailoring moral rights protection in a way that is more in keeping with how we think about U.S. copyright policy. So that's one limitation. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I would think about not offering moral rights protection for all works that are otherwise copyrighted. It is true, the Visual Artist Rights Act only applies to visual art and only to certain kinds of visual art. So, for example, photography is covered, but only if the photographs are produced for exhibition purposes only. If you happen to be doing it for some other reason, Vera does not cover photographs. My thinking along these lines is a little bit different. I think we need to offer moral rights to a broader range of works. Vera was the result of political lobbying, and that's why written works are not covered and film is not covered. It was all political and it was all lobbying, but that makes no sense. What does make sense to me is that moral rights cover works with, I would say, that manifest enhanced originality, heightened originality, with substantial creativity. Hmm. Now, people may react to that a little bit because they may say, well, are you going to have different standards for copyright law than you will for moral rights? And what I'm saying is absolutely, absolutely. And there's no reason we can't do that. Again, people are upset with copyright law because in addition to protecting works for life plus 70 years, we have a very low standard for what constitutes an original work of authorship. It's really just a little modicum of originality and independent creativity that the Supreme Court has said to us supports a copyright. Well, it seems to me that if you're going to safeguard or try to safeguard in some way an author's meaning and an author's message, you ought to apply that law to works that truly manifest a meaning and a message and a degree of heightened originality. So that's another way in which I would suggest cabining moral rights. And people may say, well, how are you going to do that in practice? But the reality is there's a lot of mechanisms in copyright law itself that suggest ways that courts can look to in order to apply a standard of heightened originality and substantial creativity. And frankly, copyright law itself, for certain kinds of works, has that same elevated level of originality standard built into it for certain kinds of work. So there's a lot of precedent that in my book I actually draw upon in supporting how this standard could be employed in practice. So that's the second way I would cabin it.
Mm-hmm.
Third, I have two more suggestions. Thirdly, I think we have to look at attribution and integrity separately. Attribution is not particularly controversial. Everybody really wants attribution for their work. Even the Creative Commons default license is one that has attribution. Law professors who really rally against expanded copyright protection, but at the end of the day, we all want attribution for our works. That's why all law review articles have 525 footnotes per article, right? So attribution is not something that's really controversial. And what's interesting is that even very low protectionist scholars are now writing a lot about the need for attribution. And I've had people that come up to me and say, you know, it's good. It's good to put attribution on the table. It's good to be thinking about it. So I think that attribution is something that certainly is going to be easier to employ. Integrity, on the other hand, this can be problematic because a true right of integrity, as it's employed internationally and certainly in the civil law tradition where moral rights basically grew up, prohibits a use. If the author doesn't like how the work is being used, he or she can prohibit the use from being made of the work. I would suggest we think about a model in which someone cannot prohibit a use of the work in circumstances that are otherwise not violating copyright law. Okay, so what I'm saying is that if a copyright owner otherwise has the right to modify, alter, display, etc., a work, I think about a mechanism for safeguarding integrity rights that will not prohibit that use. You allow the use to go forward, but, okay, what you need to do is think more creatively about mandated disclaimers. We need to come up with legal mechanisms that if you use an author's work in a way that the author would credibly object to, if you alter it, if you display it in a context that the author would object to, you need to use a disclaimer to inform the public that this is a work or this use is being made without permission, or whatever that disclaimer can actually incorporate. And that's something certainly we can talk about. And this model actually promotes two things. It promotes the original constitutive directive of promoting progress. We're disseminating knowledge about what the original author's message and meaning is. We're not prohibiting use, but we're basically telling the public that this is not necessarily in keeping with the author's meaning and message. And so that's a good thing from my perspective.
You've covered a ton of ground, and unfortunately, we only have about 10 minutes left in our discussion. As I've thought about what you've been saying, I've thought about 15 questions I'd like to follow up with. In 10 minutes, I won't ask you to handle the 15 questions in the 20 seconds each. But to focus on one aspect of what you're discussing, you identify, of course, a major challenge, which is at what point is there a sufficient level of creativity such that under your rubric, you would establish moral rights. And I guess to put this in a context that some people think about, at least with respect to music, What do you do with authors that don't have a clear message? Does that matter to you? In other words, if you take an author that puts their work out there and either one of two things, either doesn't have a clear message or alternatively doesn't want to control use or ultimately enforce moral rights. Obviously, one can simply waive the right, but how do you account for the differing motivations that authors might have for putting the work out there in the first place?
Well, that's a good question, and it's something that I've actually, you know, thought a lot about. And you're right. You know, not all authors, you know, are consciously thinking, you know, about the kinds of, you know, internally driven themes that my book is concerned with. And there are very creative works that, you know, necessarily don't have meanings and messages. I mean, that's certainly true. And there are also perhaps works that are not so creative that do have these meanings and messages. And so, you know, no one area of law can cover every single scenario, and that's true. I think the real question is, you know, the law needs to basically set up, you know, a degree of norms. This area is one in which there's a lot of normative application that occurs. And so my response, I suppose, to that question would be that the fact that some author's work doesn't necessarily have a meaning and message, if it is nonetheless a work that is understood as extremely creative, meeting the standard that I would otherwise use for the application of moral rights protection, that work would have moral rights protection. Hmm. And what that would mean is that certainly attribution would be mandated if somebody else uses that work. I can't imagine any author objecting to that. And it would also mean that if somebody uses that work in a context that, you know, the author might object to or would object to, you'd still have, you know, some sort of disclaimer. But how would an author even be harmed, you know, by that? You know, the fact that the work would be reproduced or displayed, you know, with a disclaimer that this wasn't authorized, so what? So the public, all they know is that it wasn't authorized. I can't imagine any author really objecting to that fact, because it would be a fact, and that's really what the disclaimer would be indicating.
I think the work you're doing is critical to a deeper understanding of what we're doing with copyright law, without regard, frankly, and I would hope that certainly people in the commons community in thinking about these things would keep an open mind, because as you've identified, making a separate argument for copyright duration for the life of the author will certainly get, as you know, visceral reactions from quite a few people. Nonetheless, without regard to one's view on where copyright should be, my estimation of the work you're doing is not only that it's well thought through, but that it's absolutely essential as we discuss what we're going to be doing, not only with intellectual property law, which is really a mechanism ultimately for encouraging creation, which is really all of our goals in one form or another. The question is how we incentivize it, as well as what do we take as the critical concerns for those who are creating, which seems obviously is one of your foci. I don't want to end the interview without mentioning and discussing very briefly, because like I said, we really only have about 5 minutes left, another book that you're working on for Oxford Press entitled Authenticity of the Chosen, A Cultural Analysis of Jewish Law. Again, a fascinating title. Perhaps in the limited time we have here, you could talk a little bit about what that work is going to be focusing on.
Thank you, David. Sure. You know, essentially the themes that I'm grappling with in the Moral Rights book that I'm working on are being transplanted, if you will, and analyzed in a very different context, with the text in the book on Jewish law being Jewish law. So the text that I'm concerned about in the Authenticity of the Chosen book is Jewish law as a text. And here I would just say, you know, two points to draw the parallels between the work I'm doing on moral rights and the work I'm doing on Jewish law. The first is, just as the moral rights book is really trying to understand copyright law from a multi from a multitude of perspectives, not just an economically based perspective, but an inspirationally based perspective. I'm trying to understand Jewish law from a multiplicity of perspectives, where you have a pluralism to understanding the history and the development of Jewish law. And Jewish law is very pluralistic in terms of its development, which I think is something that is not often realized by the greater community. So in that way, there is a parallel between in terms of trying to introduce multiple voices, multiple narratives into the discourse about Jewish law. And secondly, just as my work on moral rights is about the balance between how do we preserve the authenticity of the text with access considerations, and that's really what I'm grappling with the moral rights book, it's the same inquiry that I'm looking at in terms of the Jewish law book, because here the text of Jewish law has to and must maintain its authenticity if Judaism is going to survive. And yet we know that it also has to evolve, if you will. It has to be applicable to some degree. If you're going to allow a pluralist discourse, it's got to evolve but still be based in the tradition. It's the same analysis. You know, how do you maintain authenticity in the face of development, in the face of evolution? So the many of the themes that I'm working with in the moral rights book, I'm actually grappling with, but in a completely different context, using a completely different type of text.
It's fascinating work. I'm really excited to have had you on today, as I have with many of my guests, and you are no exception. I always have the constant debate of whether I just do a 3-hour block show, which of course would be an enormous amount of time for two people to be chatting. 1 hour seems to be optimal for a radio show. However, I certainly invite you back up front to discuss these issues in more detail, because obviously we've just scratched the surface in our discussion. For those people that are interested in looking for your books, as well as generally learning more about these issues, what resources do you recommend? When can they find your books, etc.?
Well, in terms of a lot of my papers and publications, they are all on the Social Science Research Network, so they can all be accessed for free, actually, on the Social Science Research Network, SSRN.com. The book on moral rights, The Soul of Creativity, Should Intellectual Property Law Protect the Integrity of a Creator's Work, is due. I'm supposed to be giving it to Stanford in ready to roll in April of 2009. I expect it'll take, you know, about a year in the publication process after that. So that's sort of in the near future, but a little bit a ways. And then the book that I'm working on Jewish law, Authenticity of the Chosen, An Exploration of Jewish Law Through Cultural Analysis, that dates a little bit far out. Oxford and I are thinking, you know, it'll be some years down the road, because I have a lot of work and research I really need to do in connection with that book. But it's certainly exciting to think about it and to explore the themes I'm working on.
Well, Bobby, certainly, as I said, I invite you back perhaps in a year or so when the book is in final form to see how your thinking has developed and deepened as you go through these wildly complex areas, because to really fit these theories into the utilitarian theory that has dominated U.S. law is an amazing challenge. And so I commend your efforts and certainly look forward to hearing what your final conclusions are. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us on Hearsay Culture today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bobby. You've been listening to an interview with Professor Bobby Kwal of DePaul University College of Law, author of two forthcoming books, one sooner rather than later, The Soul of Creativity, Should Intellectual Property Law Protect the Integrity of a Creator's Work? And then down the road, The Authenticity of the Chosen, A Cultural Analysis of Jewish Law through Oxford Press. I'm very excited to mention several upcoming guests this quarter. There's quite a large list. You can find the schedule itself by going to hearsayculture.com and clicking on schedule. For those of you who have been listening regularly, and I mentioned on my blog, but I'll mention on my show as well, I'm in my first year of teaching at Charlotte School of Law. As such, I spent quite a bit of time teaching. And that includes preparing new classes for anyone that has prepared a course for teaching in a law school or indeed in any other academic environment. It is quite a time-consuming effort. What I do look forward to, however, is that I will have more time to be able to devote to the radio show as, frankly, I learn the teaching craft. And what that means is that I anticipate having much more regular shows than I had in the latter part of last year. And as a result, the schedule that's posted on hearsayculture.com, I'm fairly confident, will be followed relatively closely. Among the guests coming up are several IP scholars, including Professor Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas, Professor Tim Holbrook, who was visiting at Stanford and is also at a full professor at Kent, not too far from where Bobby is at DePaul, as well as Jonathan Zittrain, author of a book that's coming out, who's also at Harvard and Oxford. And I also have a number of non-IP people as well. I should also mention Mark Lemley, who from Stanford, who has been on the show before, and he'll be coming on later in the semester, later in the quarter, to discuss developments, recent developments in patent law, which seem to be happening on a certainly on a weekly basis, perhaps, as a number of Supreme Court decisions have come down. But as well, I'm going to have a number of technologists on the show as well, including Robert Friedel, several people, Matt Mason, Nick Carr, authors of recent books, as well as people focusing in innovation, including Dan Bresnahan and Tom McCraw from Harvard Business School. So it's a very, I think, a very broad collection of guests, as well as Alex Wright, the author of Glut, who focuses on the organization of information on the Internet. So we have a wide variety of guests, a wide variety of topics. I do encourage you, of course, as always, to give me feedback on this or any other show by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. And as always, you can find the show any number of ways. If you're not listening live on KZSU at 5 o'clock Pacific on Wednesdays, PM, you can also find the show by going to CIS's webpage at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, where I'm a non-resident fellow. You can find the show there by connecting to the RSS feed for podcasts, as well as going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet and Society. And lastly, you can also get all of the shows by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find not only the shows, but occasional blog entries, as well as a schedule and other information about the show. Thank you so much for listening to Hearsay Culture. I appreciate hearing from you. I appreciate you listening. And please stay tuned for more innovative programming on KZSU. Have a great day.